groping and kissing women during a 2005 conversation with then Access Hollywood host Billy Bush. It was captured on a hot mic, so there was no denying it happened, says Bloomstein. This wasn't the media being the media. This was real. And the pit of my gut just hurt. She assessed the situation and found she personally could come to terms with it because of the length of time that had passed since the incident and his apology. But there were other people who were slipping away from him because of the vulgarity of what he said. There were many of my friends, people I socialize with, who were turned off enough about it that it could have impacted how they were going to vote that November. There were plenty of people I know who stalled, who really gave it a second and third look. The people and friends that I spoke with about it, ultimately, they came back and voted for him. Accordingly, the greatest amount of social peer pressure for women to oppose Trump came in well-off, well-educated neighborhoods, places where Trump underperformed the Republican average and any prospective Trump voter would have intrinsically known before the election from her own social interactions that she was hopelessly outnumbered. So why did just enough suburban women stick with him, in spite of the social consequences and Clinton's best efforts to persuade them? Pollster Wes Anderson, who took that post-election survey that found the shy Trump voters, attributes some of the resilience of Trump's vote among suburban women to the potent pull of what he calls the echo of labor. The strict code of patriotism and manufacturing work and skepticism of welfare that was imbued in the children of the industrial age now passed. That might explain how Patty Bloomstein got to Trump. We bought the house less than 10 years ago. Over 100 years ago, it was where the Kakwa Club was located, she says, referring to the now prestigious private golf club that began on this site in the 1880s as a social club centered on aquatic sports. Bloomstein lives now on what used to be a playground for Erie's industrial rich, but she grew up in a working-class Democrat household. Totally blue-collar, Dad was a machinist, had one job his whole life from school to retirement. Mom stayed home with the six of us. We all went to Our Lady of Peace Catholic School. Her father and mother are still Democrats. I knew Dad was going to vote for Clinton. I brought the absentee ballots to them, knowing very well at least he would be voting for her. So I said, Dad, no matter who I support, you have to vote whatever way you want to vote, she explains. And so he did. But the funny thing is, now my father has changed his mind. He is happy with Trump. Can you believe that? He likes him now. A big part of that switch from my father is the way the press and establishment politicians dislike him. That and his take-charge attitude. Her father also really doesn't like the way the local paper, the Erie Times News, treats Trump. He just canceled his subscription, which he has had for over 50 years, all over the way they have reported on him. It takes a lot to crater that kind of loyalty from a paper, but they did. Both Bloomstein and her mother voted for Trump, though she had to persuade her mother. So did her husband, Chris, who owns an insurance company in town with his family. Chris always said, it's going to be Trump, and I looked at him like he had 10 heads. I thought it would be Ted Cruz or Carly Fiorina, she says. I liked her because I thought she'd be a good fit against Clinton at first, and because she's a businesswoman, smart, not completely over the top. I thought she'd be able to appeal to a lot more people. And then, when things started happening, there was a shift, and I said, you know what? I was immediately on board. He's going to win. Mark my words, I'm telling you, he's going to be one of the best presidents we've ever had. Her 17-year-old son, Max, enters the living room. He is attentive to his mom, brings her a shawl and a bottle of water. Outside, a storm is forming in the distance, and the breeze has kicked up. A flurry of sailboats makes its way back to their slips as the sky, cloudless just moments before, turns an inky indigo in the west. Erie is the fourth largest of the five Great Lakes, but its shallow depth and the prominent wind along its longitude make the western part of the lake experience significant storm surges year-round. Max is part of Generation Z, the newest cohort after the much-hyped millennials. I loved following this election because, based on the history I have studied, it is unlike anything that has happened before. I honestly wish I could have participated, says Max, who is deciding between whether he should attend a university in Pittsburgh or in Rochester, New York, for engineering. Max likes Trump, but not for the same reasons his mother does. I like his independence from political parties, an anti-organizational hallmark of this new generation. To say his mother operates on a whole different level of optimism and sheer willpower is an understatement. I never have bad days, she says. Even with cancer, it's not a big deal. It's all good. Never thought, never, never once. It wasn't a death sentence. There was actually good things with chemo. We never had a bad day driving to Cleveland. My husband, I had great support. Huge amount of friends. I had food brought to my house every day from my family. The outpouring from people I barely knew. Unbelievable. The diagnosis brought everyone together, Max says quietly. Bloomstein was diagnosed in July 2015. I had this lump, and I'm like, it hurts, it's weird, in March. Didn't do anything about it. In July, she went for a checkup, and the doctor immediately ordered a sonogram. The doctor tells me I have breast cancer, and I'm like, okay. And he goes, huh? I'm like, that's okay. Give me my records. I'll go to Cleveland. Not a big deal. 2 weeks later, she has a double mastectomy. And then I started chemo that September. Every 2 weeks, I had to go back to Cleveland. And then, to be honest, the worst part was my hair. Yeah, that was bad, Max says. Bloomstein switches subjects with ease. This neighborhood is not frontier proper, she says of the prestigious area, perhaps a hint of her blue-collar self-identity showing through. Or maybe it is. There's a lot of Democrats even here. Our neighborhood used to be more Republican, our area. As a matter of fact, Kathy Dahlkemper, who's our county executive, is from this area. She says of the one-time moderate Democrat who was swept into Congress and the House majority during the 2006 midterm wave election, and swept out during the Republican House midterm wave of 2010. To say I have disdain for her, that doesn't sound Christian, right? But I'm just telling you, she just drives me crazy because we were all on board, gave her money for her first campaign when she was in Congress, and then she goes to Washington just to become a Nancy Pelosi wannabe. I am telling you, she says, biting her tongue. Lightning streaks across the sky in the distance. Though the storm stays due west, the rumble of thunder seems to shake the house. That is the reason she lost. She is the reason I changed political parties. She didn't get it. I believed she was going to be exactly what the country needs, what the community needs. She understands how we think. And then she supports Obamacare. I went from a passive political observer to a warrior. I got full throttle involved, she says of her support for Mike Kelly, a businessman from Butler, Pennsylvania, when he ran against the Erie Democrat in 2010. Bloomstein is animated. It is clear this was personal for her. I needed to make a difference. I put my money where my mouth is. I guess my biggest impetus is, what am I leaving my son? She alludes to policy changes the Democratic majority in 2009 and 2010 made with Obamacare, and the massive surge in federal spending in the wake of the 2008 recession. That was the beginning of putting the country on the wrong track. It placed the economy on the wrong track. You can see the evidence of that everywhere around here. How could I just sit back and not get involved? I have an obligation to my son, to my community, she says. My husband is a small business owner that caters to this community. If this community is not doing well, the ripple effect hurts everyone. We have to right the ship. That drive for change from the economic stagnation of the Obama era in communities like Erie may have doomed Clinton from the start. Blumstein says she wants for her son what her parents wanted for her and her five siblings. To be able to do better than we did, to achieve more, and to be able to move back home after college and be surrounded by family if he wants that. I definitely want that, the teenager interjects. I love Erie. I want to be part of not bringing it back, but reinventing it. I don't know what its potential is. I do know I want to be part of it. I didn't know the Erie my parents knew. I know the Erie in decline. But I do know I love the ability to make a difference, remake it, be part of it. Blumstein smiles, then tears well in her eyes. It is clear he has never articulated that to her before. I had no idea, she says. And then the woman who hardly stops talking pauses, and for a long time. I want you to be and go wherever the world and your talents take you, she tells him. I am honored that you think that might be right here at home. We need a new mindset in Washington, Blumstein says. This is my thing, when I say that I truly could be an independent. I lean Republican for sure, but I think the one thing that Trump will always get credit for is that he proved that our votes matter. No matter what party we were from, our votes matter. And I haven't felt that way in a very long time. Sally Tedrow, Keokuk, Lee County, Iowa. Nestled in her home in the only residential enclave of this struggling Mississippi River town, Sally Tedrow admits she struggled with her vote for Donald Trump. I really did. It wasn't easy. All of my friends from church were really upset about it, she says. Tedrow, who is very involved in her United Methodist Church, felt the heat from some of her peers in the pew. When the Access Hollywood tape came out, it was really hard to tell some people that I had not lost my marbles, she says. But she eventually held steady for the very unorthodox Republican nominee. My friend at church thinks there's something wrong with me because I don't love Hillary Clinton, because I not only voted for Trump, but have started to really like him. She pauses, then suddenly her poodle, who has been sitting on her lap, makes a beeline for the screen door as a neighbor passes by. Dora, Tedrow says quietly but sternly. Tail between her legs, Dora returns immediately to her lap. And I'll tell you honestly, I didn't vote for Donald Trump. I voted against Hillary Clinton. I thought if I didn't vote for Donald Trump, I would make it possible for Hillary to win. In other words, if I didn't vote at all. I thought I did not want to do that. Pollster Wes Anderson, who did opinion research in 2016 for Trump's two largest independent supporters, the National Rifle Association and Rebuilding America Now, a Trump-dedicated super PAC, says that vehement opposition to Clinton was the glue that kept what he calls the shy Trump voter in place. These women may not have decided to vote for Trump until late in the race, but most had decided much earlier that they were definitely not voting for Clinton, says Anderson, whose 8-state post-election survey indicates that nearly 1/5 of Trump's voters and more than 1/4 of the women who voted for him report having been reluctant to tell friends or family they were voting for Trump for fear of social reprisal. Tedrow hardened into a Clinton opponent, but it was a migration. I had every intention to vote for Hillary Clinton in 2016 in the beginning, she admits. I think the thing I liked about her most of all was that she was a very intelligent woman. You could see that in how she formed some of her ideas on foreign affairs and some domestic issues, and I liked the fact that she's a very strong woman. So I thought I would vote for Hillary, but by midsummer that year, it became clear that voting for her was not going to work for me, she says. what changed her mind? I felt like she was not honest. I felt like she didn't have a very strong message to me as to exactly what she was going to do. I studied. I watched all of her speeches. I went to see her when she was here, in Keokuk, January 2016, and her response to most people's questions was, "Yes, we'll check on that," or "We will definitely check on that." And maybe she did check on it, but I doubt it. With terrorists ratcheting up attacks on civilians in Europe and the economy lagging in this, Iowa's second highest county for unemployment, Tedrow decided Hillary was stuck. I didn't feel that anything would change at all in terms of our economy improving or our security, she says. I just thought we were going on a downhill slide, and I thought that would just continue if Hillary got in. I didn't think she was going to change a thing. And seeing Hillary in action did nothing to allay that sense of inertia. She was just going through the motions. She was incredibly dishonest, right to people's face, about issues they deeply cared about. When people point to her emails and Comey as the reason she lost votes, I don't think they were paying attention to what people were thinking. The direction of the country was awful, just awful. By spring, Tedrow had taken interest in a new candidate, the one who was taking the Republican nomination by storm. When Donald Trump came out with his list of Supreme Court justices, for me, that was a game changer, Tedrow says, finding something concrete to go with a more general sense. But I do like Donald Trump's ideas. She smiles for the first time before giving her hedge. I just wish he had a softer manner about him sometimes, Tedrow says gingerly. He embarrasses me. That's not exactly the word to say, but oh, gosh, I think you could have said the same thing much kinder and much gentler. The city limits of Keokuk in Lee County, Iowa, are the southeasternmost tip of the state, next to Missouri and Illinois, hugged by the nostalgic embrace of the curving Mississippi River that shaped its past, and shadowed by the distance from metropolitan America that clouds its future. Tedrow lives in a lovely little bedroom community of sleepy Keokuk, where the homes are neatly cared for in a town that is waiting to understand its identity going forward. Tedrow's home is modest, but skillfully decorated. As she sits in her modern taupe easy chair, she is surrounded by tasteful antiques, candles, and photographs. Her red maple hardwood floors gleam in the late spring sun, shining through her French doors. She is dressed in a lovely buttercup yellow sweater with floral embroidered piping. Her sandy blonde hair is cut stylishly short, and at 73, she looks to be a woman 15 years younger. I grew up on a farm. We struggled financially all of the time. I guess we were lower middle class. I married a farmer. I lost him in a motorcycle accident 10 years ago. It's still painful, she says. Tedrow explains that she had often gravitated to Democrats in the voting booth before souring. I voted for Bill Clinton twice, and I voted for Obama twice. I really liked Obama. I thought he was new and refreshing, and I liked him personally. I wanted him to be successful, she says. His policies, though, she struggled with. I did not like his foreign policy. I did not like the way he handled his foreign policy. That was my main concern. And the direction of the country. He did not seem to have a handle on that. Or if he did, well, then his idea of what the direction of the country should go wasn't very well thought out. The economic problems of this country were not Obama's creation, but he did nothing to apply the brakes. In fact, if anything, he put the gas pedal on them. The regulations that hurt farming and energy impacted the small towns, more so than they were already hurting. It was like shoveling salt on big wounds, she says. All over this faded river town, smaller now in population than it was a century and a half ago, economic concerns drive conversations about politics. Obama won the place handily, thanks to voters like Tedrow, racking up a 16-point margin each time he was on the ballot. In fact, Democratic nominees carried the county by 15% or more in every election dating back to 1988, before Trump flipped that math upside down and won 55% to Clinton's 39%. Despite her reluctance to vote for Trump, Tedros says she oddly finds herself warming to him as a president. "You know, I have to admit I like him more now than I did as a candidate. On the issues I care about, he is strong. He comes from a place of strength when he talks about our economy becoming dominant again. And on security issues, he has proven to be steady," she says, her statement underscoring the irony of the moment. The same unease about America's place in the world that ushered Obama into office persisted after his election, eventually preventing his Secretary of State from succeeding him. "America's prestige in the world, and even here at home, has dwindled in my estimation. I think there's some of us grassroots people, obviously, that are proud of America. And I don't think that that was the message that America was sending," Tedros says. "And I think Make America Great Again was a wonderful slogan. You know, we used to be all about God and country, and we've kind of got away from that. A lot of people have. I think this Donald Trump made it possible to go back to feeling like that." Part of what has made Trump more appealing, in Tedros' estimation, is how the media and the party establishments on both sides treat him. She sympathized with Trump with every shot they took. They show him shaking hands with the President Macron of France, and they were criticizing him because his handshake was too long. "It was a white-knuckle handshake before he let go. Really? Really, that's all you've got to talk about? He's in a very important meeting about NATO and everything, and all they could talk about is that he held the President of France's hand too long and made his knuckles turn white. Isn't that ridiculous?" Tedros asks. Since Trump's election on the strength of his vote in Midwestern locales such as Lee County, Trump voters like Tedros have watched as news reporters attribute fictional motives to them that they don't recognize, forgetting that many of these exact people delivered the votes that put Obama into office. "I find myself very frustrated with the television. I just turn it off. During the campaign, I watched a lot of news, a lot of news. I watched a lot of the political stuff, and I did that up until the election, and now it's got so ridiculous, so ridiculous, so slanted. But I get very frustrated with it, so I just turn it off. I think I don't need those things going around in my head, you know?" As coverage of Trump has become more hyperbolic and more antagonistic, it only stands to reason that voters, even mild-mannered Methodist matrons like Tedros, could pass lasting judgment on the news networks, just as they checked out on the Republican Party establishment and then Hillary Clinton. If the Trump coalition broke two large institutions in American life, it's not a stretch to imagine it breaking another. Chapter 9. A Culture Craving Respect. In the short span of a generation, the face and focus of the Democratic Party nationally has shifted from a glorification of the working class ethos to multiculturalist militancy pushed by the far left of the party. That stark change in the priorities of the American political left has, at a minimum, powered the shotgun marriage of populism to conservatism, a connection unthinkable even 20 years ago. It was just 5 elections ago that none other than today's elitist Al Gore tried to defeat the scion of the Bush dynasty in 2000 with what NBC News called a populist call to arms. In accepting the Democratic nomination that year, Gore thundered from the convention podium, "They're for the powerful, and we're for the people." Gore's gambit didn't quite work, but none other than the house organ of the elite, the New York Times, spotted it for what it was, a play for the same votes that Trump would later steal from the Democrats, the swing voters in battleground states in the Midwest. Gore was clumsily trying to do what his predecessor had done reflexively, attend to the economic ambitions and anxieties of the working class and on cultural grounds. Bill Clinton's standard stump speech during the primary season of his first race for president in 1992 bore as much resemblance to Donald Trump's announcement as it did to his wife's standard speech of 2016. The former president's speech was pillared on nationalism and a critique of the economic and political elites who had taken actions contrary to the best interests of middle-class America. The ideal that if you work hard and play by the rules, you'll be rewarded. You'll do a little better next year than you did last year. Your kids will do better than you. But that idea has been devastated for millions of Americans. How did this happen? I would argue it happened for two reasons. Number one, we lost our economic leadership. Other nations began to do some things better than we do, and their economies started growing faster and faster as ours slowed down. Big, simple ideas. Number two, and this is why I'm running for president, we elected people to high office who had the wrong response to the problem. Bill Clinton, April 22, 1992, Johnstown, Pennsylvania. By the time the next Clinton launched her second presidential campaign in 2016, her speech was not a paean to the middle-class work ethic, as much as a pandering checklist to clusters of the self-styled oppressed. She attacked Republicans who shame and blame women, put immigrants at risk of deportation, turn their backs on gay people who love each other, and reject what it takes to build an inclusive economy, an inclusive society. Hillary Clinton ended her kickoff speech with an extended riff about gender politics and her own potential to break the glass ceiling, a more self-centered than audience-centered thesis. I wish my mother could have been with us longer. I wish she could have seen Chelsea become a mother herself. I wish she could have met Charlotte. I wish she could have seen the America we're going to build together. An America where a father can tell his daughter, yes, you can be anything you want to be, even President of the United States. Bill Clinton closed his 1992 stump speech in the opposite manner, with a clarion to a cause instead of a call to a candidacy. This election is about you. It isn't about me. It's about you and your problems and your promise and your future, and all these little kids who are here tonight. Hillary Clinton's campaign message was fueled by social wedges and cultural grievance. Bill's stump speech didn't mention any hot-button cultural issues at all, just kitchen-table economics and the middle-class ethos. The closest he got to Hillary's approach was pledging to provide a basic healthcare package to all. That jarring juxtaposition, by a married couple, no less, is a fitting measurement for the distance traversed by the national political and cultural dialogue of the American left over the 24-year span. Within a generation, the religiosity that was once honored by both parties became mocked by one as merely a basis of bigotry. Angst about financial insecurity was derided by coastal elites in both parties as the last wheezing of an outmoded appendage on the global economic animal. Even in the wake of their decisive role in the elections, Rust Belt voters watched on cable television as the left and journalists pigeonholed their rebellion as an ugly bout of white nationalism, doubling down on all the elitist snobbery those voters sought to rebuke. As relevant as the comparison between the two Clinton speeches is, politicians, even the famous ones, don't create national cultural movements. They follow them. Hillary Clinton's migration from chief advisor for her husband's homage to work and responsibility to her own campaign of campus-style thought policing, demographic score settling, and forced redistribution reflected not just changes in her approach, but changes in the society at large. Political scientist Charles Murray, in his landmark 2012 book, Coming Apart, attributed this growing disconnect to a widening gulf between the setters of cultural norms and the scattered millions of workaday Americans. Murray's book began with an explanation of the formation of a new upper class that increasingly consists of people who were born into upper middle class families and have never lived outside the upper middle class bubble. Murray's premise that this bubbling effect foretold ongoing cultural schism due to the prominence of the new upper class in culture, commerce, and government. The danger increases that people who have so much influence on the course of the nation have little direct experience with the lives of ordinary Americans and make their judgments about what's good for other people based on their own highly atypical lives. Murray noted that the epicenters of this new upper class, what he calls the narrow elite, people with national influence, coincided with what he called the Big Four centers of cultural impact: New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C., the places that drive entertainment, technological innovation, government, global finance, and the mass media. The emerging populist conservative coalition is in no small measure a resistance to the mores and power of those Big Four clusters. And the Democratic message of the Obama era has proven to be a purely distilled insistence on conformity to the values, societal norms, and priorities of that hyper-educated metropolitan class. A liberalism that seeks to spread cosmopolitan relativism to the masses, by force if necessary, instead of spreading economic equality, was destined to leave a decisive slice of the American electorate in search of a new home. It took an outsider to the conservative tent, like Trump, to throw out the welcome mat for them. It is not incidental that naked nationalism was an admitted feature of Trump's campaign message and was, at the same time, a pejorative used by his opponents in describing it. Many of the influencers in the new upper class that Murray describes consider themselves citizens of the world first and denizens of a single nation second, a self-description made possible by the rise of technology and the mobility and liberal arts education that only affluence can provide. Murray, blaming this gap partly on cognitive ability separation, said, "Many in the intellectual wing of the new upper class feel more comfortable around their intellectual colleagues from other countries than they do with Americans who aren't intellectuals." This sentiment of schism is not one the new upper class, as the primary purveyors of content delivered via news and entertainment, feels obligated to hide, which inevitably is pushing the nation toward equal and opposite reactions. Murray's thesis from 2012, that the American economy and education system has become a great sorting engine that drives the cultural divide, virtually anticipated the 2016 election returns 4 years later. Mid-decade census data projects that 11 of the 18 American jurisdictions with the highest concentrations of bachelor's degrees are in Manhattan, the San Francisco suburbs, and Washington, D.C., and its immediate environs. Trump's net election margin was worse than Romney's margin in all 11 of those counties, and it was double digits worse in 9 of them. In fact, Trump's margin was weaker than Romney's in 86 of the 100 most educated counties in the country, a fact that held true regardless of the jurisdiction's normal partisan leanings. This juxtaposition between the 2016 elections and all its recent predecessors is evident in virtually every state in the country. Counties with rates of educational attainment density higher than the national average performed better for Hillary in defeat than they had for Obama in victory. And counties with rates of bachelor's degrees below the national average of 29.8% moved toward the Republicans. The driver of this split is not the college education itself, but the social pressure that comes with living exclusively among other college graduates, and the political liberation that comes for college graduates who have a more educationally diverse orbit. As the Rotary Reliables group of Trump voters demonstrate, the herding effect trumps education levels. Educated voters who socialize, work, or serve among those with only a high school degree are more likely to reflect the political views of that peer group. Meanwhile, college-educated voters in places with a preponderance of double-degree households are likely to conform to their neighborhood dinner party consensus and eschew Trumpism, even if they otherwise lean Republican. Among the voters surrounded by other degree holders, 2016 saw migration even among what had been the most Republican of suburbs. Booming Williamson County, Tennessee, the wealthiest county in that state and the purest suburban bedroom of Nashville, was 11 points weaker for Trump than for Romney, even as the volunteer state as a whole gave Trump a much better margin than Romney. Similarly, Johnson County, Kansas, the most gilded suburb of Kansas City, gave Trump a bare plurality, 47% to 44%, after having given Romney an 18-point margin in 2012. Collin County, Texas, the ruby-red corporate headquarters of Frito-Lay, JCPenney, and Dr. Pepper, gave Hillary Clinton the largest share it had given any Democratic candidate for president since 1976. The reverse was true on the opposite end of the spectrum as well. In the 1,500 American counties with the sparsest concentration of bachelor's degrees, Trump's net margin bettered Romney's in all but 51. This shift was most noticeable in rural counties with small populations. Two-thirds of the nation's 3,100-plus counties have fewer than 50,000 people. Trump lost only 197 of them, while Romney and Bush had both lost more than 300. But it held true even in suburbs with lower-than-average concentrations of bachelor's degrees. In suburban Denver, Trump's margin was 8 points stronger than Romney's in blue-collar, traditionally Democratic Adams County, while he ran 4 points worse than Romney in swingy Arapahoe County next door, and 8 points worse in neighboring Douglas County. All three jurisdictions are bedroom communities of the same city. The difference? College education levels. The population of Douglas, ruby-red Republican in most elections, has a bachelor's degree incidence of 56.6%, while Arapahoe's is 40%, and Adams's is 22.2%, well below the national average of 29.8%. This schism is evident not only at the macro level of counting votes in sheepskins, but at the professional level as well. The high-tech sector gravitated to Hillary Clinton with financial support by nearly a 19-to-1 ratio, according to data cited by the ESPN-owned number-crunching blog 538.com. The entertainment sector, already heavily Democratic in its political leanings, moved even further left in going against Trump. Industry magazine Variety cited data showing entertainment figures gave $22 million to Clinton and her super PACs, and less than $290,000 to Trump. Showbiz is heavily in favor of Hillary Clinton. That is not surprising, wrote Variety editor Ted Johnson on Election Day. But what is different from previous years is just how lopsided the level of support is. Technology companies in Hollywood infect the political discourse through a slow drip, but journalism drives it on a daily basis. And while Republicans have long argued there is a media bias against them, the evidence points even more strongly toward it in the Trump-Clinton race. In trying to put his finger on a definition of media myopia in 2016's election, political data journalist Nate Silver cited research by academicians John Woolley and Gerhard Peters showing that of the major newspapers to endorse either Romney or Obama in 2012, nearly half of them, 46%, went with the Republican. Meanwhile, Only 3% of major endorsing newspapers in 2016 went with Trump. While it is not completely fair to presume editorial biases always bleed into the newsroom itself, Silver argues that the most elite beat reporters were at a minimum guilty of not noticing what was happening in swing states. National reporters often flew into these states with pre-baked narratives, Silver wrote. And the top news sources, such as The Times, The Washington Post, and Politico, have earned progressively more influence over the last decade as local newspaper staffs and circulations have shrunk, giving those elite misses more weight. Silver's observations of the consequences of the ongoing funnel of media influence just as easily could have been made by Murray years in advance. Leading national journalists missed the potential efficacy of Trump's grievance appeal because they exemplified, professionally and personally, the other end of the complaint. Trump's campaign went straight at the idea that cultural power was stacked against voters who live outside the elite zip codes. In his victory speech after a key early primary in Nevada, Trump said famously, "I love the poorly educated," a remark that drew swift rebuke from mainstream media outlets, but never hurt Trump electorally with his new coalition. Trump, an Ivy Leaguer himself, understood his audience even at that early stage of the nomination process. Trump's weakest jurisdictions in the Republican primaries mirrored the kinds of places where he would underperform Romney in November, the most credentialed of suburbs, which are home to the bulk of the Republican leadership and donor base. In Georgia, Trump lost only 5 of the state's 159 counties, and they were all in suburban Atlanta or the college town of Athens. In perhaps his most consequential primary victory, in South Carolina, Trump lost only the state capital of Columbia and the most cosmopolitan city, Charleston. Trump lost Wisconsin's primary, his most notable stumble, because he couldn't crack a 25% ceiling in the suburbs of Milwaukee. Despite Trump's rarely broken string of state primary and caucus victories, he was unable to attract the bandwagon support of Republican elected officials, scoring just 11 congressmen, only one of the GOP's 54 then senators, and just 3 sitting governors. One reason Trump failed to get support from Republican elected officials was his mold-breaking, non-ideological approach. But another is the fact that it was simply not socially acceptable to support him among the country's thought leaders, a group that included donors and strategists in both parties. Even in the pitchfork-era GOP, the professional strategists and fundraisers who color the opinions of elected leaders live in the kind of higher-income, college-educated suburbs that proved to be Trump's worst ground. That split result between the densely populated locales and the sparsely populated locales in the Republican nomination contest demonstrated that the GOP itself is not immune to the tug of the larger cultural forces powering its new governing coalition. The emerging schism between the intensity of support for Republican candidates who represent this populist conservative fusion in rural and industrial areas and the newly competitive nature of educated suburbs that previously tilted Republican is the core axis of our new politics. Democrats used this schism to score a big victory in the first statewide test of post-Trump politics, the Virginia governor's election of 2017. Buoyed by a 24% increase in turnout over the previous election 4 years ago in the suburbs outside Washington, D.C., among the most educated places in the nation, Democrats were able to win the Old Dominion's governorship in a rout. The Republican nominee for governor ran up Trump-like margins in the state's rural counties and small towns, but even a 13% increase in turnout there was insufficient to overcome the anti-Trump consolidation of the state's most educated suburbs. Democrats are betting that the realignment the Trump coalition presents will have added benefits for them in dense jurisdictions everywhere, even the most exurban reaches of the country's metropolises, the outer ring places where people have traditionally moved to find lower property taxes, safer streets, and cheaper houses, bringing with them the historically Republican outlook that drives those impulses. The challenge for Republicans is to keep the Trump coalition intact in rural and small-town geography, while preserving the pre-Trump partisan breakdown of suburbia, a feat that will require keeping long-time Republicans voting their party, and newer Trump voters voting their cause. The tax cut, passed by Trump and congressional Republicans in late 2017, will be the policy hook on which the GOP seeks to hang this effort. These competing objectives will color the strategies of both parties for the next 2 to 3 national election cycles. But it's not just political operatives who must make strategies that factor in the competing social pressures in a fast-sorting nation. The consequences of the divide flow down a one-way street, according to Murray. It is not a problem if truck drivers cannot empathize with the priorities of Yale professors. It is a problem if Yale professors or producers of network news programs or CEOs of great corporations or presidential advisors cannot empathize with the priorities of truck drivers. The decision makers of cultural institutions and corporate brands tend to reside not just in more educated places, but in the most educated places, the handful of places Murray tagged as the most important super zips in the toniest neighborhoods of New York, Washington, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. If the people who make branding, news, and political decisions are immersed in environments hostile to a coalition that represents a governing majority of the nation, cultural schism is the most likely outcome. As those with access to the megaphones of culture become more hegemonic and less sympathetic or even less cognizant of the opposite half of America that lives outside its enclaves, it becomes inevitable that a siege mentality will set in among the consumers who see less of their values and priorities in the dominant culture. Otherness becomes manifest in collective action, particularly in electoral politics, and in 2016, that action found its vehicle in Donald Trump. The driving construct of otherness, manifest by Trump voters in both the Republican primaries and the general election, is at its core driven by perceptions of respect. We spent all of our lives doing the right things. We pay our taxes, we give back to our communities, we volunteer at our churches, coached or served on the PTA at our kids' schools, and we voted for President Obama, and still we are ridiculed. Still, we are considered racists. There is no respect for anyone who is just average and trying to do the right things, says Cindy Hutchins, the store owner and nurse in Baldwin, Michigan. Our culture in Hollywood or in the media gives off a distinct air of disregard to people who live in the middle of the country, as if we have no value or do not contribute to the betterment of society. It's frustrating. It really wants to make you stand up and yell, "We count." Except, of course, we don't. At least not in their eyes, explains Amy Giles Maurer in Kenosha, Wisconsin. All hard work has value. All people eventually contribute to the fabric of the country. But live in a small or medium-sized town, and you would think we were dragging the country down. What we do here matters. We aren't a country just made up of large metropolitan areas. Our politics and our culture up until now has dictated that we are less than in the scale of importance and value, says Michael Martin, a Rotary Reliable in Erie, Pennsylvania. Even nearly a year after Trump won, the political class is fighting to respect the voters who put them in office. We are either part of a cult, or dumb, or whatever the insult du jour is. And that becomes part of the culture, explains Trump voter Rick Novotny in Erie. Data indicates the Trump voters who perceived a lack of respect were right. The Pew Research Center's poll, 1 week out from Election Day, found that Clinton backers, particularly highly educated ones, have more difficulty respecting Trump supporters than the other way around. wrote Pew's John Gramlich. 58% of Clinton's backers agreed with the statement, "I have a hard time respecting someone who supports Donald Trump for president," while only 40% of Trump voters said the same of her supporters. This mentality of a cultural siege was made manifest in the campaign. Unlike in campaigns during the three decades prior, traditional culture battle lines such as abortion, gay marriage, criminal justice, and welfare policy took less spotlight in 2016 than a security issue that overlaps with culture: immigration, both from nations to our south and from the Muslim Middle East. Trump's non-political, often coarse language on this issue served as an attractant for the kinds of marginal voters who were previously unmotivated by more conventional Republican candidates, such as Mitt Romney, who awkwardly talked of self-deportation as an immigration policy, and John McCain, who had at times been the Senate's leading GOP advocate of a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. And contrary to pundits' expectations, this harder-edged approach may not have cost Trump votes he otherwise would have received among Latinos. Exit poll data showed a comparable Democratic margin among that group in both 2012 and 2016, though Hillary Clinton's Latino pollsters disagreed with that number. But Trump's approach to border issues did change the way Democrats and media figures, and in some cases prominent Republicans, reacted to him. When Trump first called for temporary curbs on Muslim immigration in late 2015, he used blanket terms based on religion alone, and the reaction to him was as coarse as his own approach. Former Governor Jeb Bush called him unhinged. Clinton called him reprehensible, prejudiced. Senator Bernie Sanders called his speech racism and xenophobia. And Democratic Governor Martin O'Malley labeled it fascist. Trump's actual plan evolved over time from a religious test to a short-term ban on immigrants of any religion from 7 enemy or failed states. But its effect on the campaign itself was arguably driven not by his specific details, but by the siege effect generated by the reaction to Trump. Trump's critics on border subjects galvanized many Trump voters. They saw one candidate who shared their anxiety about immigration's potential connections to domestic terrorism being attacked by an entire political and media establishment that blew off that concern as bigotry. This pattern was repeated through many other campaign episodes triggered by Trump's imprudent and inherently impolitic tweets or remarks. He falsely said a judge sitting in a case against him had a conflict due to his Mexican heritage. He got into a days-long dispute with the family of a killed-in-action Muslim soldier after they spoke against him at the Democratic National Convention. And mere weeks after he launched his campaign, he implied that illegal immigrants were disproportionately responsible for the nation's rapes. Each time Trump rocked the crowded campaign media landscape with a bombastic, racially charged statement, he commandeered the attention of the political world for days afterward and drew counterfire that his most loyal supporters interpreted as overreaction. Clinton's most extreme and costly overreaction came 2 months out from the election. She told a crowd of donors that you could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables: the racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. A survey conducted by the Washington Post and ABC News soon thereafter found that nearly two-thirds of registered voters, including almost half of Democrats, found her labels to be unfair. And for a certain strain of Trump voter, this polarization, fueled by the left-wing reaction to the Trump action, became motivational. Nobody ever likes being called a racist. It is the worst possible thing you can call someone, especially someone like me, who has raised several children of a variety of races. They just say that because they don't know how to understand someone doing something different than what they have done. It stops the conversation instantly, and it is just awful. Awful, says Renee Dibble in Ashtabula, Ohio. The professional left focuses heavily on race-related questions in analyzing the Trump vote, but race-tinged subjects were rarely cited by Trump voters interviewed for this book. The Great Revolt Survey asked 2,000 Trump voters in the 5 Midwestern swing states to rank 4 key Trump campaign promises in order of importance to their vote, and his pledge to build a wall on the Mexican border was ranked a distant 4th place. 34% said bringing back manufacturing jobs to America was most important, with a mean rank of 1.98. 30% said protecting Medicare and Social Security was most important, with a mean rank of 2.28. 28% said putting conservative justices on the U.S. Supreme Court was most important, with a mean rank of 2.49. And 7% said building a wall on our border with Mexico was most important, with a mean rank of 3.25. Trump's comments about the southern border with Mexico no doubt also caused cross-pressure in his coalition, helping him with the populists, but harming him with a bedrock group in any winning Republican coalition. The people the Democracy Fund's Emily Eakins calls free marketeers. These voters support more legal immigration and made up 25% of Trump's vote in her study, which tellingly shows that these more traditional Republicans actually mirror Democratic attitudes toward African Americans, Latinos, immigrants, and on race in general. However, they did find common ground with Trump on the newer subject of the temporary ban on Muslim immigration. By broadening the immigration debate to include not just hopeful economic asylum seekers from Central and South America, to focus also on potential terrorists, Trump found a way to unite much of the Republican Party on an issue that had divided it recently. This accomplishment will likely get him no credit by his internal critics, who blanch at his intentionally crude and divisive rhetoric on immigration topics. Pre-election and post-election portraits of the Trump coalition too often shortchanged this complexity of its subgroups' motivations and the cross-pressures between them. The political accomplishment of Trump's candidacy may be his ability to fuse together two or more wings of voters who came to him for often conflicting reasons. Chapter 10. Pragmatism Before Ideology. Whether it was by design, by impulse, or by instinct, Trump's often ad hoc campaign had one disciplined aspect, a single tenet that made him unique among presidential candidates in 2016. He was an exciting pragmatist. History is littered with losers from both parties who were unable to make a focus on competence interesting. The money line from Governor Michael Dukakis's acceptance speech at the 1988 Atlanta Democratic Convention was, "This election is not about ideology, it is about competence." Senator Bob Dole, a Washington pragmatist, if there ever was one, posited his campaign against the myth-weaving romantic Bill Clinton, to use Dole's words almost exactly, as one embodying a certain wisdom wrought by the gracious compensation of age. Dole and Dukakis, like Walter Mondale before them and John McCain after them, found that the pastels of pragmatism are a sorry opponent for bold colors of an ideological cause. But Trump managed to not only eschew ideology and win, he mocked it, even in the philosophical hothouse of a Republican primary. "I watch the speeches of these people, and they say the sun will rise, the moon will set, all sorts of wonderful things will happen. And people are saying, 'What's going on? I just want a job. Just get me a job. I don't need the rhetoric. I want a job,'" Trump said in his announcement speech, mocking his new colleagues in the political profession. Trump's announcement speech included the word "deal" 12 times and some form of the word "negotiate" 10 times. Trump managed to make mere promises of management sexy, because he used it as a common cudgel against disparate forces his voters resisted, from Barack Obama, and by proxy Hillary Clinton, to China, to multinational corporations. "We have all the cards,"